Cody Wilson grabbed the nation's attention in 2013 when he posted a video of himself firing the Liberator, the first fully 3D printed firearm. He's now embroiled in an ongoing lawsuit with the State Department over whether or not he can post the printing plans for the Liberator on his company website. He lost his case in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals after they ruled that national security trumps the First Amendment right to disseminate information in this case. But Wilson is pushing ahead on the legal front and with a new project, the Ghost Gunner, a do-it-yourself milling machine that allows you to construct an unregistered AR-15 in less than 3 hours without leaving the comfort of your own home. It's available on his website for $250, and Wilson says he's already moved thousands of units. We met up with Wilson at Defense Distributed's manufacturing headquarters in Austin, Texas, to talk about the Ghost Gunner, his ongoing lawsuit, and his journey from disaffected liberal to crypto-anarchist creator of the 3D gun, as documented in his new memoir, Come and Take It, The Gun Printer's Guide to Thinking Free.
The book on its most superficial level is a recounting of how the Liberator came to be. But it's also at times a kind of beautifully written meditation on the nature of the modern nation state and the position of the dissident thinker within that state. And it's also kind of packaged as a how-to guide, not how to make a 3D gun, how to be someone who would think of creating a 3D gun when it didn't exist before. So what exactly were you aiming for with this book?
Well, thanks for those descriptions. You couldn't help. My publisher was saying from the very beginning, we want a manifesto, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted an excuse to tell the story about how the Liberator was made, of course. The narrative of the Liberator is the excuse to take you into these places of anti-state thought, if you will. Mm-hmm. But even that is to like make it a little dry. It's just a somewhat, like you said in the beginning, what is it to have to think 3D printed gun, or what is it to have to think something contrary to what is deemed to be official knowledge, or the official course of things? Where do you have to go? What is the moral trajectory required? What happens to you, and what do you give up? That's something I just wanted to communicate to people, because I was not the same person at the end of that than I was at the beginning.
The beginning, where this idea kind of springs to life, is you're in a hotel, it seems like a hotel lobby, with some friends having a discussion about WikiLeaks, and one of your friends comes up with the phrase wiki weapon.
Yeah.
Tell me about the concept of a wiki weapon and how that kind of started your thought process.
For months in the summer of 2012, our only thoughts were, well, we could print a gun, and we were just vaguely, familiar with and boosters of WikiLeaks. It seems obvious now to say, well, WikiLeaks for guns, but we weren't thinking of it in those terms for weeks and weeks. And when that finally kind of crystallized for me, I was like, my God, we didn't have the language of crypto anarchy yet, or the cypherpunks yet. We didn't really know. We were doing something that had a kind of vague political feeling, but didn't have a name. In those moments, WikiLeaks for guns happened. We all just kind of understood, like, oh, this is the mission. It was always going to be the internet serving guns. Oh my God, what a vision. And it was just like an instant realization for us.
And what is the power of WikiLeaks, or just kind of the wiki concept, to you?
I think internet natives, or guys our age and younger, when we discovered Wikipedia for the first time, what that was doing to knowledge and the collaborative democratic production of things from the bottom up, essentially. We just understand, even without being able to write a dissertation about it, we understand that the internet was doing and serving political tides that were wholly undesignated, unsupervised, and that the internet would mean all these politically consequential things, and that we would be a part of it. So, it was wholly accidental, and I want to emphasize that a lot of this book is about capturing the accidental with the will of the political, and just kind of letting the objective irony of the universe fill your sails.
Keeping in that vein of this being an overtly political act, early on you say, I believe the printed pistol lays bare Western ethical ideology. What is that ideology in your view, and how does the pistol reveal that?
So I'm specifically referencing, in the sense of Badiou, ethical ideology, that there's a undergirding moral force in our politics that's just kind of assigned or assumed without question. This is often the ethical ideology of progress, that technological progress is good, that it has a good moral force, and that we do good things when we contribute to the technology enabling the democratic. All these assumptions are incorrect. When people say, we'll be on the right side of history, or they kind of expect or play along with this idea that technology has a progressive force with history and everything is leading towards some type of cohesive whole, this integrationist idea that history is eventually moving toward, you know, we're all getting smarter, we're all getting better, everything's getting better, politics is getting not as conflicted. Mm-hmm. Politics now is about totally eradicating the forces of difference and antagonism, and indeed, I would argue, the essence of politics itself. We are striving toward, in our moral progressivism, our ethical ideology, we are striving toward an age where politics is kind of after the fact, and a post-political era where, look, what we're not, you know, Hillary Clinton's arguing, look, you know, borders, whatever, culture, whatever. Those are just points of conflict. We're a part of a global integrationist whole. We are stronger together, all right? This is her Hegelian unionism.
Yeah.
And I would argue that has a certain bankrupt moral force that is just assumed to be dominant, but really can't drive people, isn't interesting. So I stand against these ideas.
You've described yourself as a crypto-anarchist.
Sure, sure.
What is the political point that you're hoping decentralized distribution of weapons is going to push forward?
There's both the symbolic power to what we do that we've always recognized and played with, but there's also, I would argue, a deep political realism to what we do. You know, in this shop, we make machines that produce AR-15s. We sell them by the thousands and ship them by the thousands. These go to people who can then make literal AR-15s in military specification. There's a certain political realism here. If you have the implements outside of federal observation for military-grade hardware, I mean, if you have that hardware and can produce it, you have certain political capabilities that perhaps your neighbor does not. We believe in a reality of politics at the end of the day, even though, like, I like to hang out, especially in the book, in this Baudrillardian, you know, kind of sphere,
yeah,
where it's all about, you know, how do we sap the symbolic power of our enemies. We operate on both spheres, and therefore it's somewhat schizophrenic. I want to show something with the book, the fluidity of ideology, but also, indeed, like the transformative necessity of, I mean, even like the transcendent necessity of politics. I begin as a liberal. I discover the cypherpunks and crypto anarchy, and then by the end, I'm not even sure I'm an anarchist anymore. I feel like I'm almost just like the accidental node in something else. In my book, something deeper and not at all concerned with the affairs of men.
One of the kind of grounded political thinkers you reference is James Harrington and like the Republican radicals.
Yeah, yeah.
And this idea of a universal militia, which really is the basis of the Second Amendment when you dig down to it.
Absolutely.
What does that mean in the modern context to you?
So the Second Amendment, if we're being honest,
yeah,
comes from this neo-Republican tradition. From a controversy in Republican politics, you know, as a reaction to monarchy, that has nothing to do with our current concerns, right?
Right.
We are decadents, we are provided for, you know, a political economy as and division of labor have seen to it that we don't really feel the need to be our own farmers, our own soldiers, and really like whole civic beings in the way Republican theory of the 18th and 19th century saw that we might be. The early Republic of America is gone, and those Republican radicals are having a conversation we don't even understand. But one of its lingering effects was written into our document, and it was that all men, all freeholders would have military-grade weapons. They would form the basis of the defensive forces of the country so that there wouldn't be a standing army or a mercenary force, and so that we would have a better moral economics, civic structure that would be less prone to a kind of corruption that could create military forces that could then overturn the country.
Hmm.
It almost makes no sense at all anymore. And in fact, even the good Second Amendment literature calls it embarrassing or terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
But it's here.
Hmm.
And almost like in the work of Agamben, almost completely unique in history, the founders wrote in a duty to resistance and a right to military-grade hardware into the founding documents. Hmm. Incredible. Incredible to me.
The governments control nuclear weapons and other high-grade weaponry. So what sense does it make to even have everyone armed? Does it matter?
If I want to put my liberal hat on, I can say, sure, governments control nuclear technology. But as the big lawsuit I have against the State Department demonstrates, governments have never controlled certain calibers of weapons from their birth. They've never actually controlled the people's right to keep and bear arms. That's an Anglo-American tradition that was always first in the hands of the people.
Mm.
So you can say, like, well, we live in a high-tech age, a post-Cold War age of really incredible technology that the government controls from birth, but that's never been true of the firearm. Perhaps the technological moment then begins to make you question, access to the farm, but it's never been easier to make these things, and it's always been easy to make them. But let me take my liberal hat off. Let me go back to this neo-Republican stuff. I claim that it doesn't matter what the origins of the Second Amendment were. With the internet, we can transform this thing into duty to resistance on a global scale, right to resistance on a global scale. And we don't even need to use the words rights or duty. If it's simply a fact that the internet serves guns now, this is just a point of political life.
You're someone who runs towards the outrageous and, you know, staking out kind of a provocative position as opposed to, say, seeking middle ground and trying to find compromise there. I guess my question is, why are you such a mischief maker, Cody?
Middle ground, man. Here's the thing, right? What's the middle ground on liberty and tyranny, right? Like, you know, I'm gonna throw the softball here, right? What should I announce my intention to join the cabinet of Gary Johnson or something when he wins? Give me a break. Uh-huh. You know, give me a break. There's no middle ground here. All right, we're facing an overwhelming tide of technological superstatism, surveillance and control, harnessing of the financial networks, the information flows, and desubjectification. I mean, like of your mind, man. So. No, there's not enough extremity, and there's not enough mischief.
One of the amazing aspects of the creation of the Liberator is the role that the media played. And you go into great detail about their reactions to what you were doing. And I mean, this was at the most nascent stage where the gun was just an idea, and you were just kind of leaking out details about what your ambition was, and there was media freak out immediately. Rachel Maddow of MSNBC in particular was kind of your bete noire. She would constantly be mocking you and saying, this isn't real, yet there was a kind of nervous energy to it all. How did you view the media and use them as a tool for your own ends?
I felt actually there was always a mocking, like, incredulity. I mean,
yeah.
Rachel Maddow's, one of her first comments I ever remember was, look at that gun not failing. You know, like,
yeah.
It was one of these ideas. Or she would say, like, yeah, it's a gun, but it's a crappy gun.
Right.
I was like, well, I'll take it, right? It's like, well, they have to color the event. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
But there is the event. And of course, in so many moments early in the project, just the idea of the event, I mean, it was still a simulation. It was still just images. It was still just like, you know, if you only knew the terribly, like, embarrassing, vulnerable, like, physicality of these things, these objects would just crumple and fall apart, right? But, like, they were preserved and made so strong in these images. They were, I think I called them, like, these handmaidens of the event. Yeah, they wanted to shepherd it and tell you, like, oh, no, it's, you know, look, it's really weak. Don't worry about it. It's kind of funny almost, but it's happening. And they can't help but mark the fact that it was happening, even if, in my mind at the time, it wasn't quite happening yet. Right, that's the nervous relationship with the media.
And there's a kind of irony that they helped conjure it into reality, despite being afraid of it.
The finer points of the media are that they don't wait for the actual terror of the event to happen. They jump into the situation and complete it themselves in this nervous anticipation that we talked about. So take Liberator, for example. Once Liberator was finished, no one waited for terrorists to bring it onto trains. Journalists smuggled it onto trains and then took the pictures and put it up on the Daily Mail. And same thing in Israel. Journalists snuck it through into the Israeli parliament. I mean, incredible. And this is actually, like, this is predicted in the media theories of Jean Baudrillard. You know, they don't wait for the organic natural event to complete itself. They'll jump into the void and make it happen. So the media cannot help themselves. If I can get something 80% of the way, they will take it to its completion. And then a bit further than that, they can be depended upon to do this.
I can't help but think of a particular person when you're talking about all this, the media pushing a phenomenon into existence, and that person is Donald Trump. and we're taping this before the election,
yeah.
So we don't know.
Yeah.
You know, by the time this airs, he'll either be president or Hillary will be president.
Wow.
So what do you feel any, not necessarily political kinship, but
guilt?
Some other sort of guilt or kinship to Donald Trump? You know, like, what's your analysis of that as someone who himself has hacked the media in a way?
Who can feel kinship to Donald Trump? But he is alone in his singularity. He is, I think, an innocent, almost like atavistic force, right? Mm. He's this almost totally childish in his complete innocence. Like, he is completely honest to whatever he is, but totally inscrutable. I, And that's not me calling him, like, insulting him and calling him a fool. The man is a genius and has incredible instincts and certainly understands some of these things about the media in a more natural way than I ever will and many of us ever will. I can't place him. No one can place him. And this kind of blindness, this kind of total reflectivity is surely what is propelling him to almost clinching the presidency. That I looked at the polls today. He's within the margin of error everywhere, nationally. And he's about to close in New Hampshire here and maybe even Colorado. I mean, how is he doing? I don't know. Do I feel any affinity? I don't know. I feel awe like everyone else, complete awe. And I tip my hat just a bit to him in the book. I mean, you know, I was thinking of things in the very beginning before WikiWeapon that involved, you know, concrete manipulations and going to different markets and kind of trying to pull media. I mean, Donald Trump can play every one of these games simultaneously on every level, everywhere. He found the seam. He found the thread and he's pulled it, you know. And at the same time, there's a huge unconscious force that is propelling him, right-wing ethno-nationalism, Brexit, like all of these. The suppressed remainder is returning, and Donald Trump, I guess, is riding a wave.
You have some harsh words for the so-called maker movement in this book, and it, you know, ostensibly you're part of it, the movement where people are seizing the means of production for themselves and just making things for themselves.
Don't even use the word seize, right? A maker would never use the word seize. You have to dial it back.
Okay.
Repeat your question.
What would be a more appropriate verb in your opinion?
The makers hug the means of production.
They hug the means of production. And so you view them as kind of frivolous. Could you tell me what your problem is with the self-anointed makers movement?
Funny that you would say, like, well, you're part of the maker movement. Mm-hmm. Boy, I was never made to feel that way.
Right.
And I was never consciously represented as that. If anything, there's been, in the beginning of our project, there was a fight with the traditional crowd, the gun control crowd, the kind of political crowd, and then this other fight with the people who were supposed to be kind of working with the same technology as us. This total, well, an extirpation, really. I mean, purging everything that we're doing from their message boards, administrators telling people not to link to our content, right, on the cultural level. And then on the higher level, the level of the masthead publications like the magazine, Make Magazine, this level of curating our content, telling that what we were doing was an abortion of their principles, and we're really kind of mucking it up for everybody. While simultaneously, I began to realize in consumption of their own media, oh my God, we are the promise of their movement. If anything of what they said was true, then it was that, like, we were reindustrializing, we were doing actual real physical things, making like useful objects with their technology and then propelling those into other people's hands who actually wanted to use them. Look, this project around you right here is perhaps the most successful living open hardware project. This is what a maker project should be. You can go to conferences and where they all scratch each other's heads and look at each other, stare at each other in the face and go, you know, how can we make open hardware work? Well, you have to find a good application. You have to deliver something to people that they actually want, and that's often constrained politically. There's like superficial political scarcity, okay? There's no patents. Design patents, utility patents, copyright, like, there's nothing on these devices. These are open platforms. We sell them by the thousands and we make money on them. We propel ourselves into lawsuits and we do R&D. This is an open hardware project, and yet we are not claimed by this movement. We're not claimed by this movement because we openly reach for the political in the beginning. We say making means this. It doesn't mean this kind of just permanent diversion into nostalgia, this permanent diversion into the sandbox of late adolescence, even well into your adulthood. Grow out your neck beard, play Minecraft, and kind of sing about how you built something out of Legos today, right? This is to be ridiculed on this level, right? You have to grab like the importance and the urgency of your moment.
Right.
And I thought the most harsh thing I ever said in the book about the makers was that their revolt was not Luciferian, it was not serious. The flagship machine of the maker movement in 2012 was called the Cupcake CNC. These aren't serious people.
Right. And I mean, let's talk about what you are doing here in opposition to, you know, the Cupcake CNC.
Well, but to be clear, right, my words are critical, but I don't style us as in opposition to the makers. Okay. They do not form a part of the horizon of our ambitions. They're simply a kind of unhappy, you know, sad little thing worth talking about. The arrows and sticks that they threw are so inconsequential now. I mean, we run this shit, man.
Yeah, but people want to know, you know, what's going on in your workshop now.
Okay.
And you've moved from printing plastic guns, the Liberator that's documented in the book, to metal guns. You have something called the Ghost Gunner. Could you tell us about the Ghost Gunner project and what you hope to achieve with it?
I want to be clear, though. I mean, I didn't abandon, nor did my engineers abandon, our work in 3D printing. The Liberator printer is just around the corner here in the shop.
Okay.
And we got two 3D printers in this shop. We do 3D printing in our work here, and we still work with guns. And I have an off-site research and development center for 3D printing that has the most advanced current 3D printers. We're doing that work. But there's been, in the years since Liberator, this total stop work forced upon us by the government. Now, committed anarchists in the internet go, okay, well, post your stuff anyway. If you're so big and bad, go post it. Why can't you post your stuff? We believe that we can carve out or preserve some of what we did in the courts right now. At least we have the opportunity to, and we have the resources and the means to. We have the legal talent to. And so I built a Ghost Gunner, this parallel organization and company that surrounds us now. We make a milling machine. We sell a milling machine that helps you finish AR-15s, AR-10s, soon 1911 frames. You can have the real physical implement to military specification in your hands. You can complete that for yourself outside of the Federal Firearms Network. That's a real good thing for people. People like to buy that. And when they buy that, they support our lawsuits, so I don't have to stand out there all day being like, oh, I'm a victim, help me. Oh, please, the government wants to get me. So this project is to help us preserve the days and the moments and what we thought we gained with the events of the book, Come and Take It.
So you see this as a kind of preemptive insurance policy against gun control, because now...
The Ghost Gunner?
The Ghost Gunner, yeah.
We're trying to push through facts on the ground that change what the political reality is, independent of our institutions and our processes, okay? Hopefully one day it won't matter what these men and women in black robes say, because you just know that you can download the AR-15 from the internet, crank one out in your garage, crank two out in your garage if you're having a bored Saturday, okay? This is real. This is more real than any Reagan appointee clinging to life somewhere in New Orleans who tells you something about your technology can ever force upon your life, you know? This is reality.
Can you tell us a little bit about the lawsuit and how it's affected your work?
Okay, a couple days after we released Liberator, the government finally said, okay, no, this isn't gonna go. And so began a process where we were stymied, forced into strange processes and boxes where we were just constantly deferred. And you know, if you read the great political philosophers of the moment, all of their theories revolve around real politics is simply in deferral. Mm-hmm. All politics is now deferral of strange forces. And so about a year into this process, once I stopped listening to my lawyers telling me, oh, any day, I was realizing, okay, this is it. It's just gonna be this permanent deferral. We will have to mount a challenge. We will have to build a team together. We will have to build a war chest to officially challenge this in the language of the state in constitutional terms, bring a facial constitutional
just
challenge.
Just to be clear on the basic facts, this was coming from the State Department?
That's right. There's a bureau in the State Department which administers the Arms Export Control Act.
Right.
So this isn't DOD, it's not the Army, it's not ATF, it's the State Department. And curiously, they look at a power of foreign affairs and say, well, if Americans do this and do too much of this and speak too publicly about this, it interferes with the executive's power to administer foreign affairs, or to be a good executive of foreign affairs. So because a foreigner could download the Liberator plans, no American has the right to download the Liberator plans. This is the literal argument in court, and it's not a difficult one. If it was about dildos, if it was about birth control, if Saudi Arabia didn't want its citizens to be able to download plans for birth control on the internet, do you think I would be in court for 3 years at this point? We know the answer to this question.
Yeah.
It's about guns,
yeah.
And gun cases are losers in this federal judiciary. In these appellate courts, they're losers. Literally, the three judge panel majority opinion statement, the linchpin statement was, normally the Constitution is a very strong protector of liberties, but in this case, so yeah, the government in certain cases, especially gun cases, gets to just wave around the words national security without making a specific claim.
Is there not a serious concern there that, you know, when we see something like ISIS, for instance, where they are a extremely decentralized movement and they inspire people over here to go on shooting sprees, that this kind of technology is going to enable that, so there's got to be some sort of control over it. That's the argument that as I understand it.
I think it's a fair question for you to ask in the nature of objectivity. Maybe I don't consider it a serious enough question. I just look at the capital stock of guns in this country, more than 300 million. Now there's estimates of 400 to 600 million guns in this country. And then I look at the nascence of our technology. It's so in its earliest phase. And then I look at how ISIS actually gets its weapons. From federal firearms licensees, sure, but through the direction of the State Department and the CIA and other proxies and affiliates in other countries that are supposedly NATO members. I mean, come on. they're driving this violence. There's no chance that we could ever drive it in a comparable and what is it, a proportionate way.
And one thing that I found interesting when you were talking about that situation was your analysis of the medicalization of language that happened.
Thank you for reading that.
For gun control. Could you tell me a little bit about that pivot politically and what you think that the end result of that is going to be?
This medicalized common sense and products liability discourse of gun control is now obvious and everywhere, but we were beginning to see it successfully focus group in 2012 and 2013. Mm-hmm. And then in March of 2013, Sandy Hook Promise came around and Silicon Valley got behind it, and Bloomberg demonstrated that his plan now, even before Manchin Toomey directly failed, but his plan would be to go state by state to use a suburban discourse,
yeah,
right, of moms and synthesizing the old moms demand action and Brady Center rhetoric into a rhetoric of products liability and safety and things that are unobjectionable. When we say gun safety now, what do we mean, right? Like, to yeah, slip it into this kind of ambiguous rhetoric.
It's no longer gun control, it's gun safety,
right,
now. Yeah.
And that cuts against them in some ways, but in many ways it doesn't, and it propels ballot initiatives because everything's unobjectionable. The public polling statewide is at 80%. We were seeing, granted my book was published only recently, but of course this was written a couple years ago. At the time, it wasn't totally clear to everyone that this was where the discourse was going. So I was in Europe at the time explaining to people, look, they've gone, you know, they focus group this shit underground, man. They're going to go toward this holy medical encapsulation of everything. They're now going to develop personal and public pathologies of gun ownership. They're going to couch everything in language of safety. There was this arc that we were beginning to understand very early in WikiWeapon that they were going to change the flow of the language about gun control.
Mm-hmm.
And that was...
Yeah, and I mean, and the shift towards safety and what you call the kind of suburbanization of the language, it appeals, I think, particularly to the baby boomer generation.
Yeah, yeah.
You have some unkind words for baby boomers in your book as well. You go on a very
well
entertaining
deserved
rant about the pilot of The Newsroom, which is this kind of terrible ode to baby boomer values. What's your beef with the boomers?
The spoiled children of history, okay? Mm-hmm. The generation that's had the easiest time, perhaps that any generation ever will, ever has, and that they can still point the finger as hard as they do. Now, sure, millennials are wrecked, and Generation Z even more so. We almost can't handle adversity, but at the same time, we still have to live with a lot of it. We save more than generations before us. We have to live with a permanent kind of underclass income, despite like our overweening ambitions. And that tension produces psychological dislocations and intense need to cultivate a individual personality and look at a struggle, right? In ways that the baby boomers never had to. They just had to keep their asses out of the war, sing oats to their parents and spin the little prayer wheels and just, you know, on one income, build nuclear families and take advantage of all that easy credit over the years. And then ask us what the problem is when everything's falling around, fucking around us every day.
Stratasys, a 3D printer manufacturer, repoed your printer once word got out that you were going to use it to print a 3D gun. And they actually reported you to the ATF for what you were doing. Indiegogo took down your campaign at some point. You're basically toxic to a PR-obsessed America. Yet you did get published by a corporate publisher. How did you manage that, and what's that relationship been like? Were they kind of surprised at what they had purchased?
Yeah. Hold on. My troubles with corporate America never ended, and indeed, like, aren't even the ones detailed in that book aren't even impressive compared to the ones I've had in the past 2 years.
Wow.
It never ends, and we know about things like Operation Choke Point, how the banks and the merchant processors and people consider work like this. Extreme and overwhelming is my relationship with corporate America, and to the point now where I don't put my name on applications. I don't put my name on official, you know what I mean, like correspondence and underwriting. I have to use other companies and other people. All credit where credit is due to my literary agency Foundry. At the same time, you might expect that most of the publishers I visited were like, oh my God, no. No, we're not going to do this.
Yeah.
So I was no bid to many things. And look, I'll go ahead and say it because I've been working with or trying to work with them for a long time. Penguin, the Penguin Group, were a bunch of right assholes about it. I mean, not only were they just like, no thanks, and you can say no thanks, but they were like, look, this book is evil.
Mm-hmm.
It would be incorrect and wrong to publish this book. I mean, that's real talk. So tell me there's not gatekeeping in publishing. There certainly is. But you can break through if your heart has had it, you know, if your head is hard enough. So Simon & Schuster put this thing out. I think they always wanted kind of something more accessible, but this is what they got.
It's impressive that they backed it. But even so, you did get a chapter censored. There's a chapter, and not by Simon & Schuster, the government. There's a chapter that is, I'd say, about 80% redacted. Could you tell me what happened there?
In the United States of America, you can't actually publish information related to making guns to the public. You can't do it. It's illegal. Now, the government knows that they can't literally go scoop up all of that stuff. It would be an overwhelming reaction. But I'm under a particular scrutiny by both the Defense Technology Security Administration and this directorate under the State Department that administers the ITAR. And it literally is a crime for me to publish the things that I published. And so I thought I must publish them and I must show you their redaction.
With the Ghost Gunner, you are, my understanding is you're able to sell the instructions to print them, but you can't give them away for free. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Because the way I want to give my plans away, I want to put them on the internet, or I want to leave them at a bookstore where anyone can come pick them up. Both of those are considered illegal by the United States government. But of course, you can sell anything in this country. I can sell a Ghost Gunner. I can sell a Ghost Gunner overseas. And I can sell a Ghost Gunner software to anyone who's a U.S. citizen with a U.S. address.
Any idea or theory of why that is true, that you can sell something but not give it away?
It doesn't follow like a coherent idea. After the Cold War, I mean, you can trace the whole history of the Arms Export Control Act from the Second World War. What was first just a limited, right, temporary restriction on literal defense articles during wartime became the framework for an entire Cold War thinking about technology and technological exchange in an era where, it's very important that our adversary not acquire our technology, that it not even infiltrate our free university system. So it became a way of guarding and guiding how we even exchange knowledge in formal and public settings. We're living with the consequences of the Cold War here. These regulations that I'm fighting haven't been amended since 1984 officially. There's some interim final rules, but they don't even cognize like an internet. An internet isn't talked about. So when you finally have an internet exploding half of these regulations, there's no way to capture it. And so they have to simply assert power where there is none, and you go fight about it in court and get a bunch of judges who hate guns to just kind of be like, well, yeah, I don't see anything wrong here.
If people want to support you and your project and what you're all about, how can they best do that?
To support the work of Defense Distributed, you can buy a Ghost Gunner. You can buy an 80% receiver. If you want to build an AR-15, buy an 80% receiver, a parts kit, from us. You know, if you want to do that work, you're supporting the work of Defense Distributed, our efforts in court, our research and development, which goes right back to the public. If you want to get to know more about us, read the book. All right, I'm selling a book. Read it. We come from a place of true millennial disaffection, but we believe in a reality of politics, which makes us romantics, because politics is dying. Politics is evaporating. Wake up. Wake up, my God. That doesn't mean you have to vote for Trump, but pay attention to projects like ours and the crypto anarchists. Support public key encryption, support Bitcoin, do everything you can to get the hell out of here and support the balkanization of this overwhelming power.
Cody Wilson, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you, man.
For Reason, I'm Zach Weissmuller.